A resentencing date is set in the case of a former teacher who pleaded guilty to raping a student. That development is our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Corin Cates Kearney.
And I'm Conrad Scheib. Governor Bullock announces a new pilot project to better manage the impact of drought, and Edward O'Brien speaks with the British Consul General about how a proposed international trade agreement could potentially affect Europe and Montana.
A resentencing date has been set in the case of a former Montana teacher who spent a month in prison after pleading guilty to raping a 14-year-old student in 2007. The Billings Gazette reports District Judge Randall Spaulding of Roundup is scheduled to sentence Stacy Dean Rambold on September 26th in Billings. The case against Rambold was settled with a deferred prosecution agreement in July 2010 after Rambold acknowledged having sex with the girl. She committed suicide before the case went to trial. Yellowstone County prosecutors revived the case in December 2012 after alleging Rambold was terminated from a sex offender treatment program. He pleaded guilty to sexual intercourse without consent in April 2013. The state appealed the 31-day sentence given by District Judge T. Todd Baugh, and the Supreme Court ordered Rambold resentenced.
In other news from around the state, an economist says if changes aren't made to Northwestern Energy's $900 million plan to buy 11 hydroelectric dams, customer prices could be higher for years. Montana Consumer Council economist John Wilson told the Public Service Commission yesterday that Northwestern should be open to compromises that put more of the risk and costs on the company and its shareholders. He says the proposed deal guarantees profits for Northwestern and is very lucrative for the stockholders of PPL Montana and Northwestern Energy. Wilson spoke during the second week of a two-week public hearing held by the commission at the state capitol to determine whether the deal is in the public interest. Northwestern officials say the purchase of the dams will assure the customers have stable rates in the future.
Governor Steve Bullock has announced a pilot project meant to better manage the impacts of drought in Montana through a partnership involving federal, state, and local agencies. Bullock says the state will join the Drought Resilience Partnership. It will bring the resources of seven federal agencies to watershed groups and committees already working on drought issues. The project will take place on the Upper Missouri River Basin above Fort Peck Reservoir. Actions could include better measurement and analysis of water, snowpack and soil moisture data, funding for Big Sky Watershed Corps members, and help in developing and implementing drought plans. The Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation will take lead on the project. The project could lead to the development of more dedicated cross-agency national drought preparedness program.
Some smoke and haze has started to filter its way into parts of western Montana, but there's no indications of any major forest fires in the area so far this season. National Weather Service hydrologist Ray Nicholas says most of that smoke and haze is actually coming from Canada.
Most of the, you know, the haze and stuff that's in the air is coming out of, like, up in British Columbia, and then there's also fires over in Washington, Oregon, even a few over in Idaho. And right now, if we look at a satellite imagery, we can see the smoke's kind of filtering down from the north out of Canada.
Several thunderstorms swept through the western part of the state over the last few days, bringing a slew of lightning strikes with them. But Nicholas says they also brought rain, reducing the risk of starting a fire.
That doesn't mean that at some point in time, you know, what can happen is you get these lightning strikes and then they can hit an area. If it's dry enough, it can kind of sit there and smolder for a while and then you can get fired later on.
The weather is expected to stay mostly hot and dry with little precipitation over the weekend. We'll have more on weather later in the broadcast.
A group of Missoula advocates called Citizens for Park and Trails gathered in Bonner Park yesterday to show support for a $42 million trails and park bond scheduled to appear on the November ballot. If passed, the bond would raise property taxes in Missoula County an average of $3 per month or $37 per year for 20 years. The bond would affect three different recreational areas in Missoula. Most of the money, around $38 million, would go towards the creation of Fort Missoula Regional Park. Group leader John O'Connor says plans for the regional park have been in development for almost 15 years and include more than just renovated sports fields.
That project is to develop sort of a regional park. It's going to have a pavilion that is actually larger than Karis Park for hosting events. It'll have over 5 kilometers of new trails in addition to the trails that are already out there, with a fitness loop, 4 new playgrounds, a dog park. It's had a lot of public input. 2008, the master plan was approved by the city in 2012 by the county.
O'Connor says the current softball fields also need renovation because of safety issues. He says balls are often hit into the nearby soccer fields, creating an injury risk. Destination Missoula Executive Director Barbara Nalen says the creation of Fort Missoula Regional Park would create economic opportunities by boosting tourism.
We are currently missing out on a huge segment of tourism, which is sports tourism, and the people who travel to attend sports events and also as spectators. They have a tendency to have a much larger household income, and they have a tendency to stay longer than just your normal visitor does.
The proposal also includes $3 million for county trails programs and maintenance. The city of Missoula and Missoula County received a $4.5 million grant last September to complete a 50-mile trail that would extend from Missoula to the Bitterroot Valley. O'Connor says the bond could fund the $900,000 and matching funds still required to start the project.
When that's done, you'll be able to bike or walk from Hamilton to Clinton. That's pretty amazing. And people want those connectivity points. I mean, it's part of the reason we all live here, right? I mean, when school's in session, the University of Montana estimates that there are over 10,000 people a day that use the Kim Williams Trail. So people really value that, and we want to honor that. And especially out in the county, I mean, county residents have, they've said it in 2010 when the county survey came out, and they said it in 2014 when we did our survey. They want more trails, more access.
The remaining $1 million would be used to help maintain and renovate up to 12 community parks in Missoula County. The Board of Missoula County Commissioners officially approved the General Obligation Parks and Trails Bond for the ballot after a public hearing on June 25th.
The British Consul General, Priya Gua, is in Montana this week meeting with officials to discuss existing UK-Montana trade and investment ties. Gua is also discussing the potential benefits of a successful U.S.-EU free trade agreement, also known as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Gua stopped by the Montana Public Radio studios this week to discuss TTIP with Edward O'Brien.
So it's really an agreement that would look to free up the barriers to businesses operating effectively between the U.S. market and the European Union market. So the European Union is an organization of the 28 countries in Europe. And if we are able to achieve an agreement that would free up the ability for businesses to operate, we're looking at doing things like reducing tariffs, being able to recognize regulations between the two groups of economies. I was just joking earlier with some of your business people right from Missoula. There are 27 different regulations for seatbelts on either side of the Atlantic. And when you're looking at two economies that are very similar, that just seems a little bit daft. It just seems to be a barrier that we're putting in the way of businesses being able to operate. So if we are able to achieve an agreement that would actually open up these barriers to trade, we think that it could have huge impacts. If you look at that at a US level, it could bring up to $120 billion increase to the US economy. If you look at that at a state of Montana level, we think it could increase Montana's exports to the European Union by almost 20%. And the impact that would have on jobs is bringing about 2,500 jobs right here to the state of Montana.
TTIP, as you know, has many vocal critics in Europe. Some feel it would give Americans another opportunity to kind of shoehorn itself, to impose itself on Europe.
Actually, when you look at the economies that we're talking about, they're two very, very similar economies. We're talking about economies that have a similar range of products that they look at, also have a similar focus on standards, which is something that's hugely important for our ability to envisage an agreement that is really wide ranging. So I think when people are criticizing the potential disproportionality of something like this, they're really looking down the wrong path, because an agreement like this would be between two very similar economies. And indeed, because it encompasses about a third of the world's global economy, you're looking at something that could really set the standard for global trade, let alone trade just between the EU and the US.
Do you think it would subordinate national laws to corporate profitability?
Not at all, because the important thing here is that you're not taking out every single regulation. You're not trying to have a free-for-all in terms of business. What we're looking at in the individual negotiations is, what are the areas where actually tariffs don't make sense? What are the areas where regulations don't make sense? And those are the areas that we're really trying to scrutinise with the negotiations that are happening in order just to make things easier for businesses to be able to operate effectively whilst maintaining the really high standards that European Union and US consumers have come to enjoy.
And on this side over here, Americans have NAFTA very fresh in their memories and hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of jobs that vanished after that. Do we have a right to be gun-shy about another international trade agreement?
Well, I think I would bring you back to the point that I made about the parity in terms of the economies. We're not talking about different labour costs in Europe. We're not talking about different standards. We're talking about economies that are very similar. And in fact, one of the reassurances that is out there from the start in terms of an EU-US TTIP agreement is that you won't envisage these large flows of investments from one economy to the other just because the economies are at a similar level, and that just won't make sense.
But international economies, they're so fragile anymore, are they not?
Well, I think there's a huge amount of rebuilding happening globally post-recession. That's understandable. But fragility is something that all governments are focused on and trying to look at how do we build stability for the future. And I think one of the core tenets of building stability for the future is actually creating stable economic growth, a stable source of jobs for the future. And that's really where something like TTIP can play a huge helping hand because it creates opportunity. And that's an opportunity that we are all really looking for in today's global economy.
Others worry about adverse environmental impacts, more GMOs allowed into Europe, degradation of these regulations that you're talking about that could also impact anything from air quality, fossil fuel extraction.
All of these issues are issues that are going to be debated in real detail as we go through the course. Indeed, just this week itself, people are sitting down around the tables in the EU discussing the detail of these agreements and the latest round of negotiations between the US and EU. So none of these discussions will be easy. But I do believe that it is possible to find a solution where we and the US will be able to maintain our high standards, whether that's in terms of environmental aspects or in terms of food quality that we've all come to enjoy through an agreement.
So as you say, the sixth round just got underway in Brussels, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And it continues through this week?
Yes.
Then what?
And then the rounds continue. So we and the US side are optimistic that we want to have an agreement that is concluded in as fast a time frame as possible. But obviously that depends on the negotiations progressing well. And as you say, we're in the sixth round of negotiations this week. So fingers crossed, we'll be able to keep forward with that very efficient timetable.
And when you meet people around the region, be it San Francisco or Missoula, Montana, or wherever you may go, do you get pushback at all? Or are people even all that dialed into this issue here in the States?
I think it's always striking when I travel around the consular region I cover how actually foreign trade, foreign investment perhaps isn't as much on the radar as it could be because of the impact it has on each individual state. If we are looking at a TTIP that would bring 20% increase in exports from Montana to the European Union, if we are looking at a TTIP that would bring 2,500 jobs to the state of Montana, that really should be something that's on every Montanan's horizon because it would genuinely be something that would be beneficial to them, to their local communities, and to their own state.
That was Edward O'Brien speaking with Priya Guha, the British Consul General based in San Francisco.
Republican Representative Mike Simpson of Idaho says a sheep research facility in the Idaho-Montana border will remain open. Simpson, in a statement today, says the chairman of a House Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee denied a move to close the facility by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack wants to close the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station near Du Bois in eastern Idaho because declining budgets mean it could no longer conduct necessary research. He sent a letter to lawmakers on June 17th telling them of the plan. The sheep station has been the target of lawsuits by conservation groups who contended it's harming wildlife, including threatening grizzly bears, in the area that is a corridor between Yellowstone National Park and the mountainous wilds of central Idaho.
In tonight's forecast, across the listening area this evening, it looks mostly clear, with lows in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the 80s to mid-90s. And now for the editorial commentary of Mark Hansen.
Why do people vote the way they do? If we are supposedly rational, self-interested beings, why, for example, do so many people dependent on government programs vote for Republican politicians so bent on eliminating their benefits? There are many possible explanations for these oft-debated questions. Studies of voting behavior belie the notion that reason is the sole motivator of political choice. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt has shown that voters are more moved by intuition than by reason, and that conservatives and liberals also emphasize different core values beginning at an early age. Now, recently published studies indicate that values central to our political orientation may also have a genetic basis. A recent study of identical twins, published in the journal Personality and Individual Differences, shows that values of authoritarianism, religiousness, and conservatism are substantially influenced by genetic factors. These values include having, quote, strict moral and child-rearing standards, valuing conventional propriety and reputation, opposing rebelliousness and selfish disregard of others, and valuing religious institutions and practices, end quote. A second study found a similar correlation between religious importance and conservatism, also based primarily on genetics. According to study authors, there is a predisposition among some individuals to, quote, adopt bedrock conservative social principles and political ideologies while feeling the need for religious experiences, end quote. They also found that the correlation between genes and beliefs is stronger in relation to social values than to economic attitudes. One of the lessons from the field of behavioral genetics, however, is not to jump to the conclusion that genes wholly define who we are or determine our behavior. For the most part, genes give people predispositions toward behaviors that require additional stimuli from the environment to bring something about. Consider, for example, another recent study that showed how the historical period in which you came of age strongly influences voting preferences. According to New York Times writer David Leonhardt, if you grew up during the administrations of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, or John Kennedy, for example, you're more likely to be a Democrat. If Ronald Reagan was your president during your teenage years, you're more likely to be a Republican. What do these studies mean for us in our politically contentious age? Journalism professor Tom Edsel suggests that research into human traits as they apply to political decision-making, quote, can enhance our understanding of the larger framework within which public discourse and debate shape key outcomes, end quote. Such understanding may be interesting, but I'm not confident that many politicians are terribly interested in understanding or developing more constructive frameworks for policy debate. In fact, we don't have much meaningful political debate at all. For us voters, recognizing the role genetics play in political perspectives and behavior may help us to find some measure of tolerance for those who hold views different from our own. But on the other hand, these recent studies also reinforce the idea that we remain free to use this information about ourselves to be more critical in our political choices. Voters might ask themselves whether the politicians who claim to represent them are really promoting their values. Is voting against wildland conservation, for example, consistent with conservatism? Is voting to cut assistance to the poor in favor of tax cuts for the wealthy consistent with religious tradition? Such policies, after all, increase inequality and are corrosive to families and to social stability. We should also be alert as to how politicians and parties may use this research to make themselves more appealing. Since we're more genetically predisposed toward social values than toward economic ones, we should watch for how politicians may use appeals to social ideologies to gain votes and then push through economic policies that in the end aren't good for us. Think of how often politicians try to align themselves, for example, with what they call Montana values. We are not and should not be beholden to genetic predispositions in matters of behavior. Rationality and freedom of choice are what make us morally responsible beings. Regardless of political leanings, whether influenced by genes, upbringing, or other factors outside our control, thinking critically about the values represented by political parties and candidates continues to be our crucial responsibility as citizens. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.